Mr. Rudd, welcome to Conversation With.
Good to be here and good to be back in Singapore.
Well, sir, in Australia, there's recently been a bill about foreign interference that's been put forward. Do you think there's been interference by China in Australian politics?
Well, let me go to the essence of the question first, which is the debate around foreign interference in Australia, and then the legislative response. The debate, I think, initiated by the current Australian government has been reasonably irresponsible, because it's so easy in a country like Australia for this to head in racial directions. And I will not tolerate any form of a racist debate in my country, particularly given its history. And so therefore, I have been very concerned that this debate could in fact become slanted against the Australian Chinese community. So that's why I intervened in the debate myself, because I thought it was starting to get right off the rails. On the question of foreign interference, any government which has an interest in Australia, foreign government I mean, will seek always to maximise its influence within our country. That's what foreign states do in other countries by one means or another. Economic influence, political influence, foreign policy influence, technological influence, media influence, entertainment influence. Now, that happens all the time. In terms of the measures being adopted in this current legislation, I do notice that the government has watered down the legislation a lot in response to pressure from my political party, the Labor Party. I think they are getting the balance right, but it still remains to be seen how the legislation will finally enter into force.
I think most of us do think of foreign interference as being, for example, by Russia in the presidential elections in the United States, as something where it is state-backed and that there are conscious goals. So is that not something that any country should try and guard against?
Well, yes, and I have...
And doesn't have to be racist.
I have long argued that Australia already possesses a large number of provisions in its criminal code, a large number of powers accorded to its intelligence agencies and to its police agencies to in fact preserve Australia's essential civil liberties. That certainly prevailed during my period in office. And from time to time, we would have to deploy those powers without going into the detail, which I won't. But the bottom line is, that is fine.
You're saying that you have had to use these?
That is fine. As a matter of national policy, we don't comment on whether we've used particular intelligence means or not. Neither does the government of Singapore, neither does any government, and I'm not about to start, even though I'm no longer in office. But the bottom line is, there is a difference between guarding against foreign interference against states, which is the entirely the legitimate responsibility of any national government, on the one hand, and having that blur into a more general discourse about the level of Chinese influence in Australia. That's where my hackles go up. That is where I become quite anxious, whether it's Chinese being targeted, whether it's Australian Muslims being targeted, or anybody else being targeted who happens to be an ethnic minority in my country. One final point is this. One of the accusations about foreign interference in Australia has been to do with the possibility of foreign-sourced political campaign donations to political parties. Well, that's where I've had a radical disagreement with Mr. Turnbull, the current Prime Minister, for this reason. When I was Prime Minister, I sought to ban all such donations through legislation to the Parliament. Mr. Turnbull was Leader of the Opposition at the time. He opposed it. And so we could have dealt with this problem nearly 10 years ago, except it wasn't politically opportune for him to do so at the time.
Let's move on to talking about China, a country that you know very well. You speak Mandarin and, in fact, are doing a PhD at the moment, which I understand is about the political thought of President Xi.
Well, actually, I've defined it even more narrowly than that. That's what you do in the academy. You keep defining these topics down. I'm trying to define what Xi Jinping's worldview is. The Chinese term is his shijie guan, the way in which he looks at the world, and it's both a classical concept in Chinese philosophy, but also a modern concept in Chinese Marxism, how you actually see the world, meaning your own country and others, and therefore what sort of society do you wish to build at home, and what sort of international society do you wish your country to engage in.
And so what is, in your opinion, President Xi's view of the world?
Well, that's why I've enrolled in a DPhil at Oxford, to try and find out. So I'm engaged in a fairly disciplined set of readings at the moment and discussions to try and wrap my head around it. What's my initial impression of Xi Jinping's worldview? I think he is a deep Chinese nationalist who is deeply imbibed with the history of his country, both its historical successes but also its historical humiliations. And so that forms a large part of his view of how China should be utterly self-reliant in its future and never subject to that sort of external pressure again. So I get that. The second part of his training, though, is that Xi Jinping's also trained as a Marxist. And when we look at the way in which Xi Jinping analyzes reality, it is using Marxist methodologies of what is described as historical materialism and dialectical materialism, the interrelationship of opposites, contradictions, etc. Mao also wrote about these things when he was building the Chinese Communist movement. And so that's another part of his formation, which is how classical Marxism informs his view, or at least his methodology, for understanding reality today. But in terms of the other elements, which is what is, let's call it the end point of what China aspires to as an end state for itself and its place in the region, the world, I think for the Chinese themselves, that's still a work in progress, but certainly it's a strong China, one not subject to foreign pressure, one which is united, one where the party is still in control, the Marxism chapter, but also a country which has benign relationships with all of its borders and, in from its own perspective, is in a secure strategic environment.
But, sir, when you say benign relationships, on the other hand, one of the very marked things that President Xi did in the recent Congress was that he made it very clear that he will not tolerate any form of separatism by, let's say, Taiwan, and that there were very strong words in which he sort of marked that that would be totally unacceptable. That doesn't sound so benign.
Now, my reference to benign relationships with China's borders refers to the 14 neighbouring states, not the unresolved question of Taiwan. Taiwan is a different kettle of fish. Taiwan is all about China's intrinsic sense of national identity, and another part of China's end state, or its future identity, is for a unified China, which includes Taiwan, which invites the obvious question, well, how? Given that Taiwan is already now a fully functioning democracy in a liberal capitalist system with its own sense of local identity, which has evolved since the events of 1949. And on that question, I've constantly said to friends both in Taipei and in Beijing that the most prudent course of action is one which continues, as Deng Xiaoping would have done, is to hand this challenge to the next generation. In the hope that future circumstances will solve it, or the next generation, who are wiser than ourselves, will resolve it.
What about places, though, like the South China Sea? The Philippines would definitely say that they don't see that in China is being benign. They would say that, if anything, China is being aggressive by putting various developments, extending the various atolls, putting landing planes, even possibly nuclear-driven planes, onto these. That doesn't, again, when come back to this idea of them being benign.
Well, China's posture in the South China Sea has been deeply assertive, and that's been the case for the last several years. Personally, I date that to when China reached a conclusion, probably in 2014, that the United States was unlikely militarily to respond to any such actions by the Chinese. I think China took its own lessons and conclusions from President Obama's decision not to enforce red lines against Syria. And our Chinese friends concluded that President Obama would be unlikely to do the same in the South China Sea. So if you look at that period from 14, 15 and 16 through until President Trump's election, there was an intense period of island reclamation and militarization of those facilities. That is true. Of course, when you mention the government of the Philippines, it's gone through an evolution of positions itself. I won't comment. I don't wish to give offense to anybody. On the resolution of outstanding claims within the South China Sea, of course, we have the negotiation of a code of conduct. That's going to take a very long time. I would certainly encourage the parties to do so as expeditiously as possible and to try and find confidence-building measures on the way through, such as the joint extraction of resources. I think when China rejected the determination of the International Court of Justice in the case that was historically brought by the previous government of the Philippines, China was doing what the United States had done at some earlier stage in its own history, which was to reject a finding of the international tribunal, which didn't happen to suit China's immediate national interests. So I think the rest of the international community would have preferred that China did accept the judgment. But the bottom line is it hasn't. And the bottom line is the US has adopted a similar posture in the past in terms of ICJ matters relating to its interests. So it's a complex reality, but the key for the future is to anchor all political and diplomatic activity around two things: the code of conduct negotiations, plus, if you can, confidence and security building measures around joint resource extraction projects.
What about US-China relations when it comes to trade? The trade wars seem to be spiraling into something quite serious.
Well, President Trump has decided that he's going to act unilaterally, and the view in the United States, given that I live in the United States, I'm head of a think tank in New York, was one which questioned whether the Chinese would respond or not. My response to our American friends was, I cannot see it being possible for the Chinese domestically, politically, simply to turn the other cheek, and indeed that's what's happening. So with any crisis, whether it's in commerce or whether it's in a physical crisis, there is this grave danger of political escalation. Once you get to a certain point, politics of face, mianzi, start to enter into the equation.
Oh, so for the Americans?
When I say mianzi, I mean for Lao Wei and Lao Ni, the foreigners.
Both foreigners and
the locals.
Yes.
And therefore, the danger, therefore, of the politics of backing down tends to push in the direction of further escalation. Now, that's why trade disputes, like any other dispute, are easy to start and hard to stop.
Are you worried about that, that it will get out of hand and it will then become a face issue and, in fact, much less about anything to do with real benefit to ordinary people, be that American workers or workers in other countries?
Because we now have the first exchange of artillery, I'm always concerned about when the barrage finally concludes. I've been around long enough to know this. But I'm worried at two levels. One is the immediacy of this dispute and when it starts to escalate into the hundreds of billions as opposed to the tens of billions, and when the landing point can be got in order to bring that to a close. But secondly, what I'm actually more fundamentally worried about is the damage this does to the international trading system. When you start to push the WTO to one side, push the WTO disputes resolution mechanisms to one side, and push to one side the underpinning assumption in international economic governance that free trade's the norm and that tariffs are not the norm, I worry about how this poisons the overall international free trading system. We seem to forget, here we are in Singapore, we're sort of in the heart of the APEC countries. Australia's a member, Singapore's a member, so is the US and China. We have built the economic development of this region since 1989 based on open economies, open trade, and increasingly open investment flows. That's what's pumped growth for all of us. And what I worry is whether we're now reaching a watershed moment where it's starting to flow in the other direction. And statesmen and women need to stand up and be counted this time so that maximum pressure is brought to bear on both capitals to try and push it in the reverse direction.
What about people, though, who say that your keen interest in China and your often very earnest defense of also the Chinese national stems from the fact that you have a bias and that you are Chinese biased?
Well, many people have raised that directly or indirectly in the past. My answer to it's pretty blunt. One, I might be a student of the East, but these veins are from the West, and that's who I am. I'm a product of a Judeo-Christian Western tradition. That's my identity. And I think the second thing is this, one of the pure public record. You've mentioned before the South China Sea. As Prime Minister, I introduced a defence white paper which explicitly raised objections to China's policies in the South China Sea, and on that basis called for the radical expansion of the capabilities of the Royal Australian Navy. That is now on foot and being implemented. Secondly, on a number of critical Chinese foreign investments in our country, when was necessary, simply said no to those investments. Thirdly, when visiting Beijing as Prime Minister and making an address at Peking University in Chinese, I raised the question of human rights abuses in Tibet directly, publicly in Chinese at Peking University. If people interpret those postures as somehow being accommodating of Chinese interests, I don't think they're being fair in their assessment, particularly when I see those who are not students of China and who don't speak Chinese shutting up on all those questions. I don't.
This, you said yourself that whatever the case is, you know, the veins that you have are from a Western, from a Judeo-Christian background. Is one of the questions that Australia needs to ask itself whether or not it's really part of Asia or part of the West? We've seen, let's say, for example, a concrete thing where President Joko Widodo of Indonesia said that he would be very happy to see Australia with full membership in ASEAN. Do you think that Australia needs to recognise that it is part of this region and become a full member of ASEAN?
Let me answer that question at two levels. The first is Australia being part of Asia or not. I think with respect, it's a very 90s question. It's an old question. And frankly, I think we've got past it. You know why? Because practically every institution which is pan-regional in Asia, we're members of. We're members of APEC. We're members of the East Asian Summit. We're members of ASEM, the Asia-Europe meeting on the Asian side of the table, much to the amusement of our European friends, by the way. We are in a whole range of ASEAN plus dialogues.
But yet recently, sir, there has been some talk about trying to bring in Western teaching into the universities in Australia. Is that not something that also, you know, that is a rising worry of the rising, discomfort with being part of Asia and Australia?
Well, why I find the question very 90s is that here we are in Singapore, a multi-ethnic society, which is of Chinese, Malay and Indian origins. For goodness sake, I mean, the whole notion of Asianness is itself a much vexed question. Asia, the term itself, is a Western construct. It means the East. East of where? The West. For God's sake, I mean, it's a more complex world than that. I think Australia is increasingly relaxed and comfortable in its wider neighbourhood. And in fact, has a sense of engagement and a reality of engagement with most of the countries of the region, which exceeds some of the other countries in the region. On the ASEAN point, which I didn't answer before, I first put the idea to President Cicilo Bambang Yudhoyono as Prime Minister of Australia in 2013, an informal conversation. Well, how about it? Is it time for us to join ASEAN? And I've since put that into the public domain as well. And I think it's just a natural evolution. Of course, I don't think that's so much of a problem for Australia. Whether you guys can accept us in ASEAN, that's more of a challenge, I think.
Well, I think
we'd have to learn a whole new set of manners.
Well, I think that President Joko Widodo is the president of the largest country and economy in ASEAN. I think what he says perhaps does have some weight in ASEAN.
Well, I think it's a good thing. And you know why? Because as Indonesia rises and becomes a bigger and bigger country, I think it's far better that one of its nearest neighbours, Australia, is in fact wrapped into the same regional entity. Do you know why? Regional institutions help arbitrate the rules of the family. That's why I've been a long-standing advocate, for example, the evolution of the EIS into an Asia-Pacific community involving the Americans and the Chinese around the one large regional table, because it happens to encourage the habits and cultures of collaboration and cooperation, which you can in a large family, even in a diverse family.
Final question, sir. You have said that you retired from politics. You're not playing in that particular sandpit anymore. But we all know that politicians never really retire. They just pass away. So would you go back into politics if the conditions were right?
I've been enormously inspired by Mahathir. And so therefore, if at 92 you can make a comeback, so you heard it here first. I'll be running a campaign in 2047. It'll be called Kevin 47. I'll be just under 90 at the time. I'm sure it's going to work well.
We wish you all the best in that. Mr. Rudd, thank you very much for being on Conversation With.
It's great to be back in Singapore.